hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. Also, I have a cold. Now just published our great big end-of-the-decade issue, which you can find online at nowtoronto.com. Among the many, many lists and cultural overviews, we included a thing on the 10 best Toronto films of the 2010s, which brings us to this week's episode. My guest is Jen Pogue, an actor, producer, and podcaster whose credits are numerous and intimidating. As an actor, she's appeared in things like Silent Retreat, Chasing Valentine, How to Buy a Baby, and The Masked Saint, directed by her partner and now husband, Warren P. Sonata. Friend of the show, and congratulations, you guys. As a producer, Jen's credits include Warren's new film, Things I Do for Money, and the shorts Red Balloon, Jessica Jessica, With You Always, and Age of Dysphoria, among others, as well as her own short film, We're Not Talking About It. Also, Jen and actor Lara Jean Korostecki created and produced an excellent podcast series, Women on Screen Out Loud. Its first season, released last winter, features essays and stories read by people like Katie Bolin, Gracelyn Kung, Molly McGlynn, Jean Yoon, and others. It's a great concept, and you should definitely check that out. But first, Jen picked a movie our American listeners will know as What If, but we're going to stick with the original title, The F Word. Adapted by Ilan Mastai from the stage play Toothpaste and Cigars by T.J. Daw and Michael Rinaldi, and directed by Michael Dowse, the energetic romantic comedy stars Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan as Wallace and Chantry, two young people who meet at a house party, hit it off, and resolve to become friends. Because Chantry has a boyfriend, and Wallace doesn't want to be the guy who intrudes on a relationship. They're surrounded by a bunch of interesting folks, played by the likes of Adam Driver, Mackenzie Davis, Megan Park, Rafe Spall, and Sarah Gadden, and the film invites us to enjoy following these kids around Toronto as they meet for coffee, go to the movies, and complicate one another's lives. And that's before they're made to confront whatever it is that's been developing between them. That's the F word. It's adorable. This is someone else's movie.
When I was asked to kind of come up with a film to discuss today, and I haven't done a podcast or an interview in this kind of format before, and I'm like, what route should I go? How should I take this? And the F word just kept popping up in my mind. I think it's been a little while since I had seen it. I just rewatched it again with Warren last night, actually, which was a lot of fun. And I still have the same feelings every time I see it. It's just, it feels very close to my heart, even though I have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I get that.
I think because it's so Toronto based and it's so beautiful, and like it, I feel like it sees Toronto the way I see Toronto a lot of the time on my best days. So
yeah.
And I am just like, I'm a big old sucker for any romantic comedy, and this is one of the like late newer ones that that's come out that I've just really, really felt strongly that I loved. Yeah.
I mean, we're in this new phase of ironic, self-aware romantic comedies, mostly on Netflix, as far as I can tell, or stuff like Isn't It Romantic and I Feel Pretty, where they're deconstructing them even as they're falling into the same traps.
Yeah.
And the F word, which was now, what, 2013? Is fine.
I think, yeah, right? 2013, 2014.
It was a TIFF
years?
In 2013, I want to say. It feels like it is ahead of that curve, but also it's just so honest about what it is and what kind of story it's telling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an update of When Harry Met Sally, structurally.
That's right.
But it isn't directly obligated to it, and that makes it better. And it's got it has the love of conversation and digression that the best of the Nora Ephron films had.
Mm-hmm.
And it also features characters who are much, much younger than Nora Ephron would ever write. And so it feels alive and zippy and natural. And yeah, it's that horrible cliche. Well, the city is really a character in the film, but
yeah,
it is. It's the most East End Toronto thing I've ever seen.
It is, isn't it? It really plays Toronto for what Toronto is, which not a lot of films that film here do.
Yeah.
And we just made a film this summer where we filmed Hamilton for Hamilton, and we were very cognizant about that as well. And so, and like just showcasing what we thought the best was, and like what some of the coolest spots were, and what people would pick up on. And when I was rewatching this again, I'm like, they did that too. Yeah. They had just as much intention and like, you know, hope to do that as they did. And it's just great.
Yeah, yeah. There is something really warm about watching a movie that gets where you live.
Yeah.
Like there were scenes shot at the Royal, which is a block and a half away from here. But most of it is shot in the East End, where I've never lived. But it still feels like a recognizable Toronto. It feels like When I interviewed Michael Dowse at the time, he said that like the production office was a block away from almost everything. Oh, they just shot locally.
What a dream.
because it let them create a geography that's natural.
Yeah.
It's not the thing in Lethal Weapon where, you know, somebody leaps a bridge and then they're on the other side of Los Angeles because that was the more attractive location. This was just organic. That's the George Street Diner. That's this. That's the
Rooster Coffee with Rooster that Coffee view, and that's, the, they walk across the street to the park, and that's the view that you would see.
It's just, it's one of those things that's so sweet and simple, and I guess too, it's not a complex shoot, so you can get away with it. It's not like a massive production with cranes and things, but it is also kind of amazing that this is a movie where Daniel Radcliffe, probably at the time the most famous human being or the most recognizable human being in the world, can just wander around Toronto and do whatever he wants.
I know. We were watching it last night and I'm like, it's Harry Potter and Star Wars in the same film.
That's true.
And
I forgot about that.
And I think this was pre that Star Wars
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So I'm like, wow, Toronto was really lucky that summer. I don't know if we knew it.
There's this meme of the two of them shopping, of Radcliffe and Adam Driver shopping in the antique store, and they just put whatever, you can put whatever dialogue you want about
amazing.
How you think you have it bad, my dad sucks, and all that. But it's wonderful, too, because it really is just about having strong actors. It's Radcliffe and Driver and Mackenzie Davis and Zoe Kazan, who's just sort of quietly wonderful in the trickiest part in the film. But right down to, like, Sarah Gadon shows up for one scene.
Yeah.
And she just, it's devastating.
I know. It's true. Yeah. She's so good in that little role. Yeah. And it's kind of a Sarah that, she kind of comes alive in that little moment too. You don't get to see that side of her, like that vulnerable sort of side of her as a doctor in Too Many Things either.
Yeah,
and then also Megan Heffern and,
who else is in there? There's, it's a comic actor whose name is escaping me as we speak.
I can picture her face, and I'm just trying to think of her name.
Megan Park.
Megan Park, yeah.
Yeah.
And no, and the one who's in Jeremy's movie. Tommy Amber Peard.
Tommy, that's right.
She's her and Megan play the Zoe's best friends in the film.
That's right.
Yes.
About that. And the knitting scene, the other thing. I'm going to background this for the listener. My wife is a knitting instructor, and I'm trying to remember if this came up in the episode with Dowse, but she has a class. She taught a class at the Purple Pearl where they shot that scene. And she could not teach it that week because they were forced out for the shoot. So they ended up, they ended up in a restaurant basement or something next door teaching this class while they shot the scene. But I got to tell Zoe Kazan this in a separate situation because I'm a huge suck up apparently. I was interviewing her for some other movie the year before, just after the shoot, before the F word, either before the F word was here or the year it was here. Now I'm all confused.
How do you keep it all straight?
It's a mess. Well, because the only way I can remember this is that I interviewed her for the F word formally the following year.
Okay.
When it opened in the spring.
Okay.
Or in the summer. It opened in the summer. But I got to interview Zoe Kazan the year the film shot and tell her this. And she just lit right up because, as it turns out, she really is a huge knitter and knew who Kate was.
So neat.
So now we send her a book whenever Kate publishes one and she still hasn't done the podcast.
Cool.
So I'm just saying.
Zoe, get on here.
I mean, she's
there's
been
space
in
for
town.
You.
She shot stuff. But yeah, it is this weird intimacy that the film generates where everybody in it feels like a friend of the audience. Just there's no real villain, there's no tension. It's all about self-doubt and insecurity, and that is the most relatable subject in the world.
100% I think that's just it too. You kind of have these like back and forth with the characters a little bit. Like there's like Zoe's character. You're very right in saying that she is a complex character. Because I have moments with her that I'm so on her side. And then I have moments where I'm just like, really? How are you reacting like that? Like the very end of the film when he makes this grandiose romantic gesture and flies out after her, which is what you see in so many romantic comedies. And she like gives him heck for it. which is an interesting choice. In that moment, I was like, come on, you love it a little bit. You love that he did that. Everybody would love that you did. Yeah. But
can't so interesting that they right? made so that. She has to turn it on him.
Yeah.
It comes from a real place, even though it's not a... it's ostensibly it's the thing you don't do in a romantic comedy, but it's also a human response, which is why it's the thing you don't do in a romantic comedy. And it's such a smart treatment of, like, it's not a resolution of the situation, it just prolongs it, but it's such a great way to do that and treat the audience like they're adults by letting the performance be open enough that we can understand it.
Amazing.
I just spent the whole movie going, oh, that's clever. Yeah. That's actually how you would do that. That's a good solution.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that the screenwriter was sitting right next to me.
Were you talking out loud while you were watching this?
I might have been going, so that was fun. But
was that Elan?
Elan, yeah. Okay, nice.
I noticed his cameo when I watched it recently.
That's again, right. Too. The first time I had
it. That made me laugh quite a bit. He references to himself as the creepy doctor.
Yes. Which feels like some kind of weird parental fulfillment. It's look, I'm a doctor. Yeah. This is not what you wanted.
And the creepy one.
But it is such a sweet-hearted movie that it doesn't judge any character, but it lets them judge each other in a really smart way. Mm-hmm. And you have long speeches about morals delivered by people who are lying to themselves. You have this constant illusion of the best way to get through a situation and to be the grown-up, and nobody's a grown-up. The only really honest relationship is between the secondary characters who are just perfectly happy with each other and delighted, and they're only upset when they can't have sex nachos. Which is, again, such a tiny little moment, but Driver sells it so well.
So well.
It doesn't feel like an eccentric friend. It just feels like a natural delivery of this bizarre line.
Yes. I've never seen somebody so happy for nachos in a movie before, but I know that feeling so well when the nachos are hot and they come into the oven. And yes, I think you're right that they sell it just really hilariously in that film. Those two characters in themselves, it's Adam and who plays the girl? Sorry, what's her
Mackenzie
name?
Davis.
Mackenzie Davis, yes.
I want to make sure that's correct. She's not even, that's amazing. She's not even part of the main title block.
I know.
It's Radcliffe, Kazan, Megan Park, and Adam Driver.
Wow.
And then way in there. I always want to call her Mackenzie Cameron, but that was the character she played. Cameron was the character she played on Halt and Catch Fire. Yes, Mackenzie Davis.
Look Mackenzie at me, Davis.
Smart. And poor Rafe Spall, who is the UN lawyer boyfriend that has to be the Baxter. He has to suffer for the movie to work.
Right.
But it's kind of okay.
Right.
I'm positive there was a... did you see the... I'm going to roll it back. Mm-hmm. Did you see the original cut or the theatrical cut? Because when it played at TIFF, it didn't have the ending that it has now.
That's a very good question. I'm pretty sure... I never saw it in the theaters or at TIFF. I think saw it... I saw it on a plane, I think, was the first time I saw it. And then I said, I need to watch this on a bigger screen. And then, whenever it's been on television, I've watched it. And then we just watched it on demand last night. So what was the ending in the theatrical one?
So the original cut ends with the close-up on the Fool's Gold Sandwich. It doesn't have... It has the animated sequence.
That
is the end credits.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have them meeting at the airport 18 months later.
Oh.
Which is a really...
And the whole wedding scene to follow that as
that's
well,
right.
isn't
that's
it?
That's right. None of that happened.
Wow.
It ended on the possibility of happiness, but not the actual exposition. But the animated sequence was there. The animated end titles where you see Chantry flying off and all of those things that happen, they happen, you know, you see photos of their passports and photos of the degree and all of that.
Oh, okay, I see.
So now you watch the ending, and then it shows you that stuff again in the end credits through that animation.
Interesting. Oh, I have to watch the end credits again just to imagine that other person was in place. So do you think that that's a cut? Because then it came out in the States, and they changed the title, and do you think that that is relevant to the feedback that they got from the theatrical release that I don't know, the more general audience, so to speak, needed that closure?
It was pretty heavily implied that at the time when I interviewed both of them, both Dausan and Elan, that the studio mandated it, that it just needed an extra beat because audiences wanted to be sure.
Right.
Which is kind of sweet, right? If you're that invested and you want to make sure it's going to be okay for them. But it's weird. It was one of those things where when I saw it, it didn't have that. This was at the first TIFF screening. It was the world premiere. Didn't have the ending. And it also, I'm quite sure, had a a shot or two that really implied that Rafe Spall's character was cheating on Chantry with his Argentine colleague.
Oh.
And it was maybe even just a shot of him picking her up, because they both come home drunk at one point, and he sort of grabbed her around her waist to steady her and held it a little too long. It was a little too intimate. It was one of those moments where you just think, oh, okay, that's the out. And that's gone. So now
they made his character almost a little more likable.
Yeah, a little more innocent, which I think lands better.
Yeah, interesting.
Because we're waiting for him to betray her.
Right.
Like, we're waiting for that reason to be, that box to be ticked so she can move on.
Yeah.
But I kind of like the idea that he's just caught in the crossfire.
Right.
He's a nice guy who's not the right guy.
Exactly. A nice guy that's not the right guy. And, you know, 5 years is a long time for a couple to be together. And it's kind of at that crossroads where you're like, do we, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we don't need to make him the villain in going with your themes of how there isn't really a villain in this entire film. Yeah, that's interesting.
He still gets to punch Radcliffe, which I think is earned. Especially because
Radcliffe made him fall out of a window.
Yeah, exactly. And they set that up like on the night where he says, you're not going to try to to steal her, and he still goes out the window.
Yeah.
He's punished for seeing the truth in a weird way. He's like this this almost noble suffering that's inflicted on him.
Right.
It's like a tragic, it's like a Greek tragedy where he's the Cassandra. He sees it all coming and can't stop it.
Yes. It was funny in that window scene when we were watching it last night, Warren's like, the phone falls after, and Warren's like, oh, it should have landed on his head. That was a comedy beat that they missed.
It's true, but that would be too much suffering.
It would be a little bit too much suffering, too slapstick.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, honey, that's your humor.
That's how you create the villain.
Yeah.
But it's so sweet. It doesn't want anybody to suffer needlessly. The even putting the pepper in his eye is his own mistake.
Yeah.
It's not that somebody else does it to him.
Yeah.
And there's such a balance to that,
mm-hmm.
I think. It just keeps you on, it keeps you off balance just enough as a viewer to tell you that, no, we thought this through. We're going to be grown up about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way to tell this story that isn't so completely familiar that you can fully invest, but you can also be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
It's comfort food that doesn't want to be too predictable, if that makes any sense. Like, it's a really good hamburger.
It's a very good hamburger. Yeah.
It is. And it doesn't have to be an insult.
No. It's not a double decker. It doesn't need to be anything more than it needs. Like, it just needs to be a good, solid burger.
Yeah, it's not bad for you.
No.
It's been made with love.
Yeah, you're going to feel good when you finished it. Not too greasy.
We do have to talk about the Fool's Gold, though.
Right.
Because that's horrifying. It's real.
Yeah.
I have tried it. This is another weird story. This is the way the F word has reverberated through the city. Specifically Toronto, because Corey Mintz, who I don't know if I'd actually even met him at that time, but he and I lived fairly close together in Kensington. He was just on the other side of Spadina.
Mm-hmm.
And he announced over Twitter that he was inspired by the F word. He was going to make Fool's Gold.
Wow.
And document the process. And I read it, and I was like, this is fascinating, terrifying. Did everything that the movie said to do.
Uh-huh.
And made it smaller. Which was he made a like half size, half scale version of it. So he wasn't using the giant loaf that's used in the film. It was a smaller baguette.
Wow.
So as not to kill people,
basically.
But then what he ended up doing was announcing that he was going to take it to this cookbook shop, Good Egg, in the market, which is closed now, sadly.
Oh, is it? That's so sad.
Last year. And just leave it out and sample it. And if people were interested, if people wanted to take their lives in their hands, they should come and try it. And so, of course, I did.
Oh, yeah.
I was around the corner.
Hands down.
Yeah.
Okay. So how was
it? That was the first time we met, which was bizarre. And it was really good. I can totally understand why Elvis died. Because if you have the ability to just point at someone and say, get me that.
Yeah.
You would do that.
Yeah.
All the time.
That's hilarious. Have you seen it anywhere else as well?
No.
I feel like there's some kind of restaurant in the city that I've seen that's tried to do, to put something like that on their menu. Oh, it's not coming back to me, but I'll think of it. Yeah.
Well, there's a constant hamburger challenge, just to get back to that idea, where people are trying, like, what was the one in Queen of Parliament?
Oh, Dangerous Dance.
Dangerous Dance,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah, where they're basically just trying to kill people.
Yeah. and people were trying on the regular.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great way to be a murderer.
I guess so, yeah.
If you think about
definitely get away with it.
Yeah, you're never accountable.
And have you done the Wild Wing Challenge?
No.
At Wild Wing, they have this very, very, very extra spicy wing that if you get it, and they say if you eat all the whole thing, then you get the meal for free. So there's always somebody in your group that's going to join.
I'm happy to pay for
food. And they usually are the first ones to leave, yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I know.
I want to enjoy life and food. And just the ability to continue to taste the meal is
right.
The kind of thing that I would prefer to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, that doesn't seem like a good idea.
No.
Just the idea that if you can do this to yourself, to your body, you can leave a free man.
Yeah, it'll be good. Yeah.
I don't want to do that. we've strayed so far. But it's kind of the thing, right? Like it's a digressive film and it kind of lends itself to this. And there's that throwaway, I'm still thinking about how the movie regards food. And there's that great throwaway line that Sarah Gadon has about don't eat the sandwiches.
Right.
Because it speaks to a very rational doctor's point of view, but it also tells us how much she cares.
Right.
She really, what is that shot? 20 seconds and and all those things play across her face so quickly.
Yeah, it's amazing.
She's worried for him, and then she's genuinely sad.
Yeah.
And then she's upset, and then she gets back to being sad, really just...
with a touch of embarrassment, because as you learn what sort of happened, just kind of moments after that as well, yeah.
Yeah.
There's so much at play. Yeah, it's really, she does such an amazing job. Have you talked to Sarah? You must have talked to her on the podcast
as
well.
She did, perhaps the platonic ideal of the show was her episode. She picked Cleo from 5 to 7.
Okay.
And I'm very proud of that episode. I did nothing. I basically asked her two questions and she rolled with it.
But, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. How to Plan an Orgy in a Small Town.
Yeah.
Which probably have the most friends of the show at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a local production that just piled on the talent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been such a pleasure to be able to catch up with people, post facto, but mm-hmm. also to watch the estimation of the movie grow.
Right.
It's like this secret now. It's this great little movie that people are still introducing to each other. A friend of ours was staying over for a weekend, I want to say last summer, and she was from Dublin and the time change had hit and she just couldn't get to sleep and wanted to watch something. We watched.
Oh, nice.
She'd never seen it, so we watched it.
Oh, that's great.
And it's just delightful still.
Nice. Yes,
it is
even 5 years later. When I watched it, actually, when I put it on recently, I'm like, wow, okay, it's like, I don't know, just the way that it's filmed, I'm starting to get the sense that it is not as new as it once was, but mm-hmm. absolutely, it's still very relatable and
the score is bouncy and that cover at the beginning, it's like, it shocked me when I figured out what it was. It's a Rolling Stones song, but
the styles are fun. I remember actually watching this movie was one of the first times I had heard of a surprise wedding.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like that trend kind of started around when this film came out. And now you hear a little bit more stories here and there. And I was working in the wedding industry at the time, too. So I was pretty captivated by the idea. I'm like, they just threw a party and just told them they were getting married right then and there. I'm like, oh, that's amazing.
It is great. We had a very small wedding and we did consider...
Mm-hmm.
trapping people, but it seems mean.
There's
such potential for it to go horribly wrong.
It's true. Your mom doesn't come that day for some reason or something. Yeah.
You need the import.
Yeah.
But they set it up so well, and again, it's the good-heartedness of the film, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no way this storyline, which we were told is going to be disastrous, mm-hmm. can go so well.
Right.
And everyone's into it, and it's so sweet, and that's it. Like the gravity that forms in that story thread,
mm-hmm.
where it didn't really happen because it's Bruno Kirby and Carrie Fisher in When Harry Met Sally. It's
mm-hmm.
it's such an obvious parallel, but it actually does it better, I think,
mm-hmm.
because Fisher and Kirby are always spectators. They're never really shown to be a couple. They're they're each other. They're Harry and Sally's best friends,
right.
and it's funny that they get together, but it's never given any further consideration, but
right.
the F word gives these characters lives and interests and quirks and a relationship that actually forms in real time and on the film. What is it? Maybe 30 minutes of screen time total?
Yeah.
But you get this complete arc of a couple that's going to be fine. They're going to stay together.
and rooted in just genuine passion and love.
Yeah, it's
really sweet.
Whereas Wallace and Chantry have to get there.
Yes.
And it's labored and awkward and mean and
right.
Yeah.
And but also very deep. Like, what I think it's a beautiful story of friendship as well, just like Harry Met Sally. Like, they just really get to know each other so well before it. Well, I think that stuff is kind of at play at the very beginning, but until it actually physically comes into play. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a flirtation that isn't coded as flirtation.
Yeah.
Right? When, of course, you are absolutely doing that. Like, mm-hmm. it's about the exploration of chemistry and the way that works. Mm-hmm. It's funny. There are so many movies that try to do it, and I am a sucker for romantic comedies where really smart people are blindsided by emotion. Mm. And just when, you know, your body betrays you or your heart betrays you,
right,
and you don't know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my favorite, because that is how I fancy myself. I'm overly articulate and way too in my head and all of that stuff. So when you meet someone who knocks you back,
right,
it's the thing you can't prepare for.
Right.
And it's wonderful, and it's especially wonderful to watch other people suffer through it for my entertainment.
Like, right.
In a fictional context where I know no one's really going to get hurt.
Right.
This does that. This is that. These are two really overqualified people, mm-hmm. who shouldn't be with, you know, anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a good 90 minutes for one of them to figure it out.
Yeah.
And she's not punished for it. Yeah. Not really. Like, nobody is.
No. And they definitely, there's a whole journey with it, for sure. And I don't think anybody necessarily betrays anybody. It's more of like an internal battle between the two of them and trying to do the right thing, but feeling like they're doing the wrong thing. And then eventually, yeah, they never, I do respect her very greatly for, she obviously feels very deeply and has a lot of thoughts throughout this, but then, you know, make sure that she is, that other relationship is done before she bounces into this one. And I think it's a really lovely journey that you watch her go through. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going to say Zoe Kazan's an underrated actor. I don't think she is. I think
like,
she's amazing and people get it.
Yeah.
But
she may have been at the time when they filmed this.
Yeah, that was it. Like, it was right after Ruby Sparks and maybe,
yeah.
And she hadn't made, I don't think she'd made the HBO thing with Frances McDormand yet, Olive Kitteridge.
Oh, that's right.
That was sort of a major...
I actually haven't watched that yet either.
She's really good.
Oh, cool. And The Big Sick.
And The Big Sick, that's right. Yeah. That was still a couple of years away.
Yeah.
I knew her best for, I think, Meek's Cutoff.
Oh, okay.
Which was 2000 and I want to say 10.
Huh.
But it's one of those performances where you see everything she's got,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't feel like a showy role.
Right.
It's all really small. Like, just even the way Chantry dithers over her job,
mm-hmm.
feels real. It feels like somebody who doesn't know what she wants yet and has to figure it out. And mm-hmm. we're watching it happen, and she will grow from this, but she hasn't done it yet. So, mm-hmm. you know, you see all this. You see her paralyzed by her own potential, I guess. And she's
right.
constantly putting herself down. And
right.
And again, her boyfriend is supportive. He's right. not a bad guy. He's trying to help.
Yeah.
He's just... just not the right guy.
Just not the right guy.
Yeah.
Just not the right guy.
Aww. Poor
but guy. I'm sure he did just fine.
Well, I have a headcanon here where he went on to be the same character in Jurassic Park, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and so he does not do well.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure it's the same guy.
That's interesting.
Yeah. He's sort of allowed evil to win in his heart, and he's been pushed all the way over. But he plays like this high-priced lawyer for the evil guys, and
it
turns out he's, spoilers for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, he's orchestrated, because of course he is.
Right.
But he's orchestrated most of the worst things that are happening,
uh-huh.
and then he is made to pay for it. And it's like, yep, same guy. I'm
okay.
almost positive. It also makes the movie a lot more fun.
That's okay. I'll have to make sure that I look out for that when I watch it.
Well, yeah, now there's an F World expanded universe. And
yes.
F word, F World. You can make it work.
Yeah, the F World. Which one could that be? That's so fun.
Yeah. Cool. It's such a nice movie to talk about. And like, really, there isn't a lot of tension. There isn't a lot of, I mean, there is. There's like an overarching tension, but it's the tension that will be resolved, because there's never any question, really, that they'll get together.
Right.
It's a film about that.
Yeah. I kind of like to think I'm like on bored with the original ending that you just told me about now. I kind of like it that we leave it and we can make what we want out of it as well, rather than being told exactly what happened. But I think that I would have assumed exactly what happened is what they ended up making happen, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that you need...
Yeah, you don't need all that.
It's reassurance that the movie has already given you.
Exactly. Yeah. Because anything could still happen after the wedding, too. You don't know.
Sure. Yeah. There's always the possibility of a bad burger.
The bad burger.
something that changes the relationship. And, yeah, I think we're told that Wallace finishes medical school, and we're told that Chantry succeeds in the overseas office and all mm-hmm. of these things. I mean, they literally say it to each other in that weird little thing, mm-hmm. which is... It's cute, and it sort of mirrors their initial meeting, but it's... A mirror after a mirror, and that in the previous party scene is the perfect mirror for the film.
Right.
And that's where it ended.
Yeah.
So it's weird. I every time I see it now, I'm surprised by the extra beat. It's like, oh, that's right. They added this. They didn't need it. Sorry, guys, if you're listening, and I know you are.
Yeah. Fun. How many times have you talked about the F word on your podcast?
No, this is the first time.
Oh, really?
It's never
is
come
it?
Up. Yeah,
oh,
I mean,
I'm surprised. The director and the writer.
Yeah, well, when Elan did the show, I think it was a year after, because I didn't start the podcast until 2015. Mm-hmm. And he was just one of the first people who did the podcast. And
that's great.
He picked, what did he pick? Kicking and Screaming, the Noah Baumbach film.
Oh, okay.
Which was good, but it didn't really line up at all with the F word. So,
right.
Other than naturalistic dialogue. And when it was Dowse's episode, it was for the FUBAR Vice series.
Okay.
So it came up here and there, but he picked Heaven's Gate, which really doesn't line up with the F word.
Ah.
So yeah, this is probably the first time we've had any really long, sustained conversation.
Oh, good. I'm glad to bring it to the table.
Yeah,
then.
I try to avoid repeats, which is good.
That's very good.
But yeah.
Dowse didn't really seem to have much of a history in romantic comedies,
no,
right?
No,
so
not at
did
all.
He say anything? I'm just curious about how this came, what spoke to him, and also, like, he just executed it so beautifully.
Yeah.
So, I mean, which obviously speaks to him as a filmmaker, but...
We mostly talked about the... When I interviewed him, when the film came out, I interviewed him for Now, because we put Radcliffe on the cover, and it was there was a whole package. It was, we talked to Dowse, we talked to Kazan, we talked to Radcliffe, and it was, yeah, the Elan interview was more informal. It was just the two of us hanging out in a hallway during the press day.
Nice.
But the biggest thing I got from it was that it was offered to him, and he really thought it was a fun, like, a new thing to do.
Okay.
Because he made FUBAR, and he... done some television, and I think he'd already made Goon. The first Goon would have been the year before.
Wow.
If I remember correctly. I might be wrong about that. But yeah, he had written the Don McKellar remake of The Grand Seduction,
mm-hmm.
which was, I mean, his first attempt at a romantic comedy, but he didn't direct it. And then he directed this, but he didn't write it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a different... I think he just wanted to play with the levers and see how it all worked.
Okay.
And the fact that he wasn't really practiced at it, I think, makes it better, because mm-hmm. he didn't see any previous mistakes that he'd made that he wanted to correct, and he could just rip the material apart and make it work as a movie rather than a genre.
Right.
Because all the other ones, like in this current wave of self-reflexive romantic comedies, they're always commenting on specific tropes and...
Right.
The lighting is a little brighter, and they're sort of parodying the old 90s setups, but the F word is just a movie that happens to take place in this genre. It's not arguing with itself about what kind of film it is.
Right.
It just lays things out. Like, it doesn't look like previous romantic comedies. It really, like, the Harry Met Sally thing took me a good half hour to hit me, which was bizarre.
I agree with you on that, though. Yeah, it takes a little bit of time to warm up, sort of. I don't know what that is. It's been a while since I've actually watched it, but yeah, why did it feel that way for you?
Well, it doesn't have any of the cues. Like, it doesn't have the musical sting, the construction, like all the oldies that Rob Reiner put in, and all just the way that it establishes their relationship very swiftly with mm-hmm. the road trip. And none of that is here. So these two people show up at the same place and have a connection and then start doing the walk and talks.
Right.
And the difference, I think the other big difference is that in When Harry Met Sally, there isn't already a boyfriend.
Right.
Or a girlfriend. There isn't an obstacle in place.
Right.
It's just that they don't think they get along, so right. they decide not to sleep together.
Right.
And here they can't.
Yeah.
Which changes the relationship. But yeah. then once you figure out what it's doing by, you know, the time they drop in going to see The Princess Bride, directed by Rob Reiner, it's just like, oh, okay, I get this. Now I got it. But it wasn't immediately evident, which I think is really kind of lovely.
From her, the first thing she says, yeah, we should definitely hang out. Here's my number. I gotta go see my boyfriend now.
Yeah.
Like, interesting way of putting it on the table that you have a boyfriend and just kind of throwing it on there. But she's obviously intrigued from the get-go as well.
Yeah. Yet.
Otherwise, you wouldn't give the number. You'd lead with the boyfriend. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's something that comes up in other films as well, where, mm-hmm. you know, there's always an obstacle mm-hmm. in these things, but it's handled so gracefully here because it does feel like she's made a split second choice mm-hmm. initially not to tell him
mm-hmm.
and now she's sort of
the
guilty.
Guilt yeah, yeah the yeah. guilt overcame her
yeah, yeah. which is again it's
gotta
a perfectly
put it on the
human
table.
Response
yeah. yeah yeah and absolutely and there's nothing to be said that they couldn't still just be very good friends as well, like they're definitely you can definitely still have a Plutonic. I think that's interesting what you said about the exploration of chemistry and who sticks around and who doesn't. And yeah, but yeah, there's definitely something right from the beginning.
Yeah. And yeah. it's so difficult to get that right too in a movie. I mean,
yeah.
now you've got chemistry reads and calculations and all that, but this is a tiny little film with just happens to be, again, with like one of the biggest stars in the universe yeah. making this movie. And it's amazing how he's been able to transition. I've met him a couple of times, and the last time we spoke, I think it was long enough that I really got a decent sense of who he is instead of your 10-minute hit and run interview.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just so committed to not being famous anymore or not being that anymore.
Okay, cool.
That yeah, he has nothing but positive things to say about making the Harry Potter movies. He's referred to them like millions of times as the best theater school, the best acting school he could ever have.
Amazing.
And yeah, I mean, you're 8 years old and you're surrounded, or 10, and you're surrounded by the entire royalty of England theater.
And the franchise film. Of the entire thing. Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah.
I mean, he does say he can't look at his first three movies. He just, he all he sees is a kid who's trying instead of an actor.
Right.
But once he figured himself out and once he knew what he could do, he's challenged it over and over again.
Yeah.
Here he is in a Canadian romantic comedy playing a loser.
Yeah.
Like it's like playing someone with no confidence and who's racked with his own insecurities and neuroses, and it's a completely credible performance.
Yes, indeed. Well, not yet. Very much so. And we also recently watched, I'm going to forget the title of it. Hopefully you know. But the movie where he's basically a corpse the entire time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Swiss Army Man.
Swiss Army Man.
Which is
ridiculous, but so fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's, I think, when I'm like, okay, this guy is willing to play.
Yeah. Well, he said that, you know, like that was the greatest advantage was that Gary Oldman told him.
Yeah.
And this I think is in the piece. He said, like, you have fuck you money. You can do whatever you want and you don't have to do anything you don't want.
Right.
And he's just pursued this really odd career.
Yeah.
And of course, Swiss Army Man is co-stars.
You got it right there?
Yeah.
Of course you do.
My
Amazing.
Natural gesture, but it is right there. But it's stars Zoe Kazan's partner, Paul Dano.
Oh, I didn't realize that connection either.
And he produced, Radcliffe produced something else as well for Dano. It might have been the Brian Wilson movie?
Okay.
I don't remember. But they're really tight.
Nice.
He works with people he trusts. He continues to do so. And they both just seem, both Kazan and Radcliffe, both seem like genuinely interesting people who have accidentally ended up mm-hmm. pretending to be other people. Because a lot of actors, I think the attraction is they just want to not be themselves for a while.
Right.
Blanket opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, I completely see the appeal. But mm-hmm. I think the fascinating thing about Kazan and Radcliffe is they both grew up in front of cameras, basically, mm-hmm. and they have decided to be interesting people.
Right.
And it's a choice.
They have decided to be interesting people. I like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you see all the examples of how not to be.
Right.
I think if you're in the industry for any length of time.
Yeah.
Or this is just something that's been on my mind lately because all we're hearing now, it's been, you know, like 2 years of the exposure of bad behavior and
right.
bad people, and that's absolutely needed.
Mm-hmm.
But then you start to think about the good people, right, and how important that is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a producer.
Yeah, no, same ways. It's, you work with so many personalities in this industry, and there's just not enough time. And any project that you attach yourself, even if it's a short film, you know that it's going to take the next year or two of your life and mm-hmm. and the space that you have. Like, so we might as well work with good people that you trust yeah. and that you enjoy being around and that lift each other up, because there's just not a lot of time otherwise. Yeah. Now, I would pick, I mean, I don't think the distributors would say the same thing, but I would pick somebody I love and trust over the name, you know, yeah. that would, you know, hopefully sell your things. And then hopefully just the work speaks for itself and you go about doing that. But yeah.
Yeah,
no, it's great to hear her say that. It's true. I mean, and that's what we as filmmakers need as well, right? Like, you got to have your support system in your basis. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like anybody in this movie would be that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like there's any, and we'll probably find out someday that, you know, some bit player was throwing things around at the wedding scene or something. I know, there was some disturbance.
Yeah.
But it feels like a movie made by people who just really enjoy what they're making. Like, this specific film is something that everybody's pulling together on and just into, and it's such a sweet movie. I just keep coming back to it.
I do love hearing you say, that these people connected, because they probably did. I don't know if they worked together before this film.
I don't know if they did.
I don't think that I've seen them credited together in anything before this film. But
oh, Cassandra Radcliffe. No.
Yeah, Cassandra Radcliffe.
Definitely not.
But continue to work together are fine ways to continue to work together in their pools afterwards. And you can tell that films like that, and I've worked on films like that too, that are just have that it happens a lot of the time when you go away, which is why I love to go away and make something, because it's almost like you're going to a film camp.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody can just kind of be in that space, and you're all there together, you know, making a creation, living your passions, doing your thing, hopefully getting paid at this point and stage in your career, you know, but even in the indie world, and you really come together as a team to make something happen. And then that's when these relationships are formed and, like, hopefully can continue on. And so I know Kelly comes from that world of like going away and to a cottage for, yes, you know, right, many, many weeks on end. And like, and that's when you really get to know each other, and it's beyond just being professional and knowing your craft. It's about becoming a team and the bond. And it's amazing when that continues to go on. So Laura Jean and I, actually, who did the podcast with me, we worked together on a film, The Masked Saint.
Oh, yeah.
A number of years ago. And we were all up in Sault Ste. Marie for a couple weeks together. And so that's just another example of, like, a wonderful relationship. Because I'm sure our paths would cross in Toronto quite a bit, but I don't think we would have had that camaraderie that we were able to establish when we were kind of in the middle of nowhere in November together. So
yeah, it is kind of amazing. Yeah. Every time someone discusses, like, a business incubator, it's like, that's a film set.
Yeah.
I understand how that works.
Yeah.
You just, everybody locked in the space together, yeah, with a thing that they have to create. And if they don't learn how to coexist,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Yeah.
It won't be a good thing.
It won't be a good thing. And yeah, you're kind of just forced to, and yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's what I love about the F word. You just get the sense that people got to play in Toronto and not pretend it wasn't, and
be very human in their characters and in everything. And I'm sure that they had the best crew available to them too, because Toronto has some of the most amazing crew. So I'm sure it was a great set. And yeah.
Oh, that's right. And like 6 or 7 years ago, it would have been before all the TV production snapped up on the tech.
Yeah.
Because it's different now, right? Like, the landscape is definitely different, mm-hmm, I think, in terms of an independent, small, I mean, this was produced by E1, but it's still like a very small production compared, absolutely, to the other things that shoot here.
Yeah.
I just saw Natty Zavitz's film.
Oh, great.
Yeah, have you seen
it? No, but I'm invited to the screening on Saturday, I think.
Oh,
so hopefully we'll get a chance to see it. I love Natty.
Yeah.
His first film premiered at the Canadian Film Fest.
Edging,
Edging, which was awesome. And then we go to the same spin class. And we've been bopping around together on a bike. Yeah. I'm really proud of him, though. It looks like an awesome film.
Yeah, it's the closest to the F word, really, in the setup, because it's about two people who meet and are both in relationships, but are still attracted to each other.
Okay.
And, well, I mean, as we were talking about this, it's like, oh, yeah, there is another movie that does that, but it doesn't, because it immediately acknowledges the physical connection, the chemistry.
Right.
And that changes everything about the movie, but it is still people sort of walking around the city. This one's mostly set in Parkdale and Queen West. It's almost like it's deliberately the other side of the city from the F word, even though they're otherwise unrelated. And it's really, it feels much more of a Toronto present day movie than the F word does, because the city has changed, and even in 5 years, there's a major subplot about home ownership destroying a couple, and how it's just, they bought a place, they're in their early 30s, and it's eating them. And it creates the distraction.
So real.
It's so of the moment. It's really smart, and probably by the time this episode drops, it will be on VOD, so people should go hunt it down.
Oh, fantastic.
It's the other film that I would think of in this sort of Toronto specific young people romantic comedy movie.
Right.
Area, but it's also less of a comedy, which is also fine. It's just not where it's going.
Yeah.
So this does bring us to the other question of the podcast, the closer, which is there anything of the F word that you've borrowed or lifted or just full on absorbed and stolen into your own creative DNA?
Oh, I think quite a bit of it, which is why I relate with it so much. So, I mean, just in terms of the characters, it's just so human, and it's just such a lovely portrayal of how we really are on a daily basis, and when we meet people, which we're constantly meeting people, especially in the city, you know. I think it really grabbed me when they first had that conversation about breakups as well, because it's the first time I really heard a character, Zoe's character, he says something like, oh, I've been in this many relationships, but I always got out when I knew that they were coming to a close. And she said, oh, well, I always just kind of try to... What did she say? She goes, I always just try to keep them going. That's just who I am. And I do whatever I can. And I'm like, I've never heard anybody say that before. And it's very true. And I feel that's very relatable to me as well. I'm like, in most of my relationships, be it friends or past boyfriends, which I don't have a ton of either, because I usually just did everything I could to make it work.
Probably me too.
Yeah.
It's
hard to say goodbye to people in your life, and especially when that chemistry is there and that bond is there and things are so strong. So, but I think it's a beautiful testament, and I mean, obviously it worked out for them and maybe not for her ex-boyfriend in the film, but...
He's got Jurassic World to take care of. Fine.
Yeah, he'll be okay. I think it's just a beautiful testament to relationships and chemistry and following what sparks and eating... trying new foods.
It is about that too. I mean, that's the other point that I wanted to acknowledge. I couldn't figure out how. But you're right, there are so few opportunities for people to be social that don't involve eating, so you get this tour in the movie of all the opportunities there are to just sit and talk over a dish of something, and that's I think Sex and the City ruined that for a lot of American films, because they made them have to have destination locations for that stuff.
Right.
You know, if this movie is a success, everybody's going to want this cupcake, so we have to find a real product that we can hook onto, or product placement becomes an issue.
Right.
And the F word is just way more honest about it.
Yeah.
They go to one club and it's a disaster.
Yeah.
But otherwise, that's the great thing too about Wallace, is that he's basically a 50-year-old man in a 25-year-old's body. So he's constantly complaining about the world that he's in.
Yeah.
But his pace is definitely sitting at diners and having coffee and walking around instead, because that's the Billy Crystal old man vibe, I think, from When Harry Met Sally. And this was based on a play that didn't do any of this stuff.
I noticed that, but I don't know the play.
Nor do I.
No. Okay.
I understand that it was very good. Everybody seems to like it, and that the film is a radical reinterpretation.
Okay.
So I think it was really just the two of them. And so all this other stuff that's been added, the superstructure of the movie, is borrowing from other romantic comedies and acknowledging that in a way that makes it feel somehow more real, that the characters would acknowledge popular culture and that all these things happen. I don't know. I don't know that you can get away with it on stage in the same way. You'd have to directly quote the source material.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's a funny world. Even when we were just talking before about Skyping people from other rooms and how often... I think this movie is so lovely in that they just are getting to know each other so much, and then just having these lovely little conversations, and it shows all these destinations, and it really kind of makes you I want to go for a walk right now and go see Riverdale Park again. You know, I'm like, I forgot how beautiful that view is.
Yeah, I never get over there.
I know, right? Why do you, unless you need to go to the East End for any reason, but Toronto does have so much amazing stuff to offer. And it, I think just because I've been here for such a long time now, I know you were born and raised here.
Yeah,
Yeah, I've been here for probably about 15 years now, which I don't know where that time went, but I used to do that on a weekly basis when I first moved here, and now it's kind of just my commute to where I have to go, then I come back home and I watch something, or I...
Yeah, I mean, that's life, right? It's just what happens.
It's just what happens.
You settle in
to
where you are. But it's been weird. We've been here in Little Italy for 3 years, and tried maybe a quarter of the restaurants we want to try, and so you just like, well, it's cold.
Same. I usually just I found a couple that I like, and I usually just keep going back to them.
Yeah.
Actually, that's another shout out to something that I saw in this film, the Dunright Inn. They do a scene right in front of this place on Queen Street West, right at Queen and Claremont, called the Dunright Inn, and we do not live far from there. And when we first moved into the neighborhood, the Dunright Inn was a staple. It was a beautiful little gem of an Italian restaurant that was way underpriced and gave you such a huge amount of incredible food, and probably the reason why they don't exist anymore today. But
it's not still there because I missed it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We have Hot Mess. We have the Tex-Mex place up on College.
Oh, Hot Mess. I haven't been there yet.
Absolute, total shout out to Hot Mess.
Hot Mess. I'm coming for you.
They are, tacos for days. They're so good.
Is that the one they actually have the real queso cheese, too? Yes. Someone was telling me about this. Okay.
Yeah, it's
I think
right across
I might
from
have
Royal
to make
Cinema.
A stop after this podcast.
You should definitely. They open at 6. You'll make it.
Excellent.
But yeah, I think that's pretty much everything. Is there anything else you want to throw in?
No, I don't know. I just,
anything else coming
it's
up
a lovely, lovely film. I think that it's one of those films that will also, like Harry Met Sally, I think that I can go back and watch it in another 10, maybe 20 years and still feel the same things that I feel after watching it the first time. And that's, you know, that's a special kind of film. So
Yeah, it holds up in a way that it sparkles. I hate saying things like that because it sounds like they're cute.
Yeah.
But it's such a sweet, charming, it's, you know what it is, it's the kind of movie we don't make here.
Yes.
And that makes it feel even more special.
Yes, it's very true. Yeah. I think that's really interesting. I hope that we make more of it because I'm definitely a big fan. That's the kind of movie that I'll always throw on, when I just need a feel good. But it's very true. I do work for the Canadian Film Fest, and I don't have anything to do with programming there, but I watch all the films when they come. And this year, especially 2019 I think it just speaks to the testament of, you know, the way the world is right now. But the films are very dark and very heavy, and that's fine and that's important. And these stories need to be told and these messages need to get out there. However, everybody loves a good pick-me-up sparkly movie as well. So I really hope that we do continue to make those and find the beauty in our environments and our worlds. And so, I have yet to make anything like that. So I'm just putting it out there to the amazing filmmakers that we that are around. Please keep making the happy movies too, because the world needs some happy too.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yes.
My thanks to Jen Pogue, whose latest production, Things I Do for Money, directed by her husband, War and Peace Sonata. And again, congratulations, you guys, just had its world premiere at the Whistler Film Festival. It won't be out until next year, so until then, you should spend your time catching up to Jen and Lara Jean's podcast, Women on Screen Out Loud, on the platform of your choice. Thanks also to Jen Gerson. She knows what she did. You can find Jen Pogue on Twitter at Jen Pogue, all one word, and you can find the F Word on Blu-ray and DVD from Entertainment One in Canada and from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment in the US, where it's known as What If. Ugh. It's also on iTunes in Canada and on iTunes, Google Play, and Amazon Video in America. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our shiny new theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or the show in general, say so by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. Every little bit helps. It truly does. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. Jordan Heath Rawlings' excellent Rob Ford miniseries, The Gravy Train, drops its final episode this Thursday. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. And you know what? Go have tacos at Hot Mess. It's right across the road from the Royal, which is an actual location in the F-word, so technically it's still relevant to this conversation. and try the VLT guacamole. It's amazing. See you next week.